Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Our first case for argument is Tompkins against the Central Laborers' Pension Fund. Mr. Gasek.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Gary Gasek. I represent the plaintiff appellant, Mr. Donald Tompkins, and I'm pleased to be accompanied by Mr. and Mrs. Tompkins on the court's right second row. In preparation for this argument, I tried to keep it short, and I'm going to start with a summary. I see the opening two issues as sort of a preface to a book. The opening two issues are, is there a conflict with this pension fund board, or independently, was the fund guilty of some bad faith? Those two questions drive how you read or scrutinize the three issues that follow. As with regards to the conflict issue, my brief made it clear that it was through discovery of some Siegel documents, the fund's actuary, that revealed some board PowerPoint pages for June and August meetings in 2004. And without detail, they simply reflect a $223.9 million shortfall to projections by the actuary in 2004 in answer to in a question presented on the PowerPoint, what would it take to get the fund back on track, 12.5% interest for the next 7 years. And finally, the third that I highlighted was they were going to conduct follow-up reviews of disability pensioners. Nothing wrong with that individually, but in context, along with the others I cited, I believe there's a clear conflict with this board because they were aware and concerned about their financial asset status and condition.
Well, if we were to agree with your argument that the fund operated with a conflict of interest, wouldn't a decision like that have a significant impact on decision made by any fund facing financial difficulties?
I really combine it with the difficulties in 2004 reflected in the PowerPoints, followed by the 2005 draft amendment number 5, where they bifurcate their disability pension, which once was just a singular disability pension, bifurcated it into a disability pension for injuries created while on vacation off the job, and an occupational disability benefit for benefits incurred where a sickness or injury or disease is occasioned by the job. And there they cut it in 50%. So not only do you see the alert in 2004, but in 2005 you see a drastic measure is reflected in those PowerPoints, and I attached them to my reply brief as a supplemental exhibit because I flicked through them, and I didn't stop there, Judge Williams. I said, wow. And when I saw Amendment 5 in that same box of Siegel documents, a draft amendment, sole purpose was to tighten things up, and then in the follow-up final amendment number 5 to cut the occupational disability benefit by 50%.
Yeah, all I'm saying is a lot of pension funds are facing the same type of situation and taking certain measures to deal with some of the economic setbacks. And I'm just saying the implications would be then that we always have a conflict. There's always a conflict.
So be it, but they could also design their board to have a committee, a subcommittee, specifically deal with suspensions, somewhat insulated from the details of the financial plan. You have to answer that. I found in the cumulative that they met the standard of the cases I've cited, and that is they were concerned and they were the same decision makers. In 2005 they were concerned, and I showed that they were the same board members, same two counsel at that that received the 2005 draft and that were at the 2008 appeal hearing. I'll move on to bad faith. Bad faith is independent of the conflict of interest claim. And again, it was those Siegel documents that revealed, gee, this 14,000 provision first appeared in 97. And here were some documents discussing that $14,000 provision. One that implied or left the impression that it's still quite restrictive in 97. It made no mention of restricted to part-time employment. In fact, there was every indication that it covered full-time employment. And then the timeline analysis also includes that draft amendment number 5. Clearly, I looked at it and came to the conclusion, and I hope you do too, that they would never have been considering drafting amendment number 5 if Tompkins' interpretation of the 14,000 provision applying to full-time employment wasn't correct. The fact that they didn't go through with it is obvious because 3 months later they bifurcate their disability pension and chop the occupational disability in half, achieving their cost savings there. The three issues that both the conflict and bad faith preface are, one, the 14,000 provision, two, what I call the notices provision, and three, the alternative provision. The 14,000 provision had the district court seen its way to diminish deference or replace deference with de novo review, he came to the conclusion he agreed with Tompkins' interpretation of the 14,000 provision, but for deference. We've argued both unambiguously the 14,000 provision has a plain meaning and only one meaning, and alternatively, if ambiguous, the extrinsic evidence, the same evidence that we use to show the bad faith, the draft amendment number 5, the 97 documents, when there was no concern about distinguishing between part-time and full-time non-labor employment, all those go to show extrinsically that there was never any intention in 97 to restrict the 14,000 provision to part-time employment. In fact, when I checked early in drafting the complaint, in 96, the minimum hourly wage turned out to be $4,000 more than the 14,000 provision. So just another indication that it really wasn't intended to be limited to part-time employment. Number two, before I leave the 14,000 provision, the fund makes much of, gee, he's able-bodied and he's working full-time at the Jumer's Casino in Rock Island. He's not disabled. Well, the 14,000 provision made it clear that if you work in non-labor employment, and if you, at that time, with the 14,000 provision in place, you could earn up to 14,000 and still be considered totally and permanently disabled. And if it was so important in 05, the fund, when they bifurcate the disability provision into a work and non-work disability, the occupational disability provision, they drop any dollar limit and don't restrict non-labor employment in any fashion. So it couldn't have been all that important. It was important enough to where they cut it in half and they were happy, and that's where they left it.
This is a draft that was proposed but not adopted at a
Correct.
Later time.
It was the 14,000 provision first entered and was adopted on May 19th of 97. So in that time framework, it's created, May of 97. 8 years later, in 2005, the same May-type board meeting, they proposed this draft amendment with clearly 5 or 6 words to make it clear, doesn't apply to full-time employment, hence limiting the 14,000 provision to part-time employment.
But that's never adopted.
3 months later, in that same time frame, they get a better idea. Let's bifurcate our disability provision into a regular disability, injuries outside the job, and an occupational disability, disabilities on the job. And they solve it by cutting it in half. They no longer have to worry about part-time, full-time.
I don't understand how that informs the meaning of the original 14,000 provision, because it was never adopted. You know, this course of conduct postdates what occurred here and is ambiguous at best.
I simply ask, why did they do it? But for their attempt, the only inference that can be drawn is that the 14,000 provision, they're starting to tighten their belt, and let's limit it to part-time employment. Let's make that additional limitation. 8 years after they originally adopted, Judge Sykes, I can't help you any more than that with then just a straight inference. Oh, my gosh, here they're trying to insert it. I understand what they're trying to do to the 97-14,000 provision. That's clear. There's a good reason they drop that approach and pick up the bifurcation approach. Otherwise, I can't explain to you why I came to that conclusion. They notice this provision. The fund clearly was faced with, we didn't give our participants notice of the 14,000 provision. So they start characterizing the disability pension as something short of a pension, not a pension. Why? To get it out of the notice provision of Section 6 of the plan, specifically Section 6.7. If it's not a pension, well, then you're not entitled to notice. And ironically, when Mr. Tompkins put in his retirement disability retirement papers in August of 99, they have him sign a notice, but it's the wrong kind of notice. It's the kind of notice for a regular pension or a service-only pension. So they talk out of both sides of their mouth. It's not a pension. It's not entitled to notice. But, by the way, we did give a notice, had him sign it. We admit it's the wrong notice, and we never gave notice of the 14,000 provision. Mrs. West's affidavit makes it clear that they didn't mail the 14,000 provision in 97 or 98, two amendments to the plan. Then give them the right one in 99. They didn't put it in the SPD in 2000. And not until 2007, when they give them a suspension letter, do they tell them. I do not mean any disrespect, but and the notice provision, it was akin to, you're suspended for violating the rules we didn't yet give you, but here's a copy anyway. And they had no trouble giving Mr. Tompkins a copy of then Section 1.31 containing the 14,000 provision the day they suspend him, but never since 97 to 07 do they give him a copy of the 14,000 provision.
I just want to get back to your bad faith argument.
Please.
Do you have any evidence that the trustees ever discussed any of the documents that you mentioned in connection with your bad faith argument while they were discussing Tompkins' benefits?
I've given you the best I have. So if it's not here, I don't have it.
All right.
If I could clarify before you sit down, just what is at stake here, because we only have a part of this case on appeal. We don't have the whole case. The counterclaim was decided against the fund. We don't have that. So they can't recoup this affirmatively, this overpayment. What's really at stake is whether the alleged overpayment can be recovered against future pension benefits. Is that right as a practical matter? What's going on here?
No, if the fund follows its rules and gives it proper notices, you don't have my notice issue. If they're claiming that the recovery process doesn't apply to the disability plan, that turned out to pop up and bite them, I guess. But, you know, I wouldn't propose that they don't have a right to recover.
If I could focus my question a little bit more, what the argument is about now is about monies that were overpaid to your client on his disability payments.
Yes.
For the time period when he was earning in excess of $14,000 for
correct,
those
Judge
for
Sine.
Those years, about a 2.5-year period,
correct.
Something like that.
I think it came to 60 months.
Okay. And that can't be affirmatively recovered by the fund at this point. They lost their counterclaim. They haven't filed a cross appeal. We're talking about whether they can recover that by way of offset against future payments?
I respectfully think there is a way for them to recover it. That recovery paragraph allows them, when he's back on a payment roll,
okay.
to start deducting the first month 100%,
right.
next
that's
month,
my question.
Next month 25% off the check successively till they're paid.
Right, recovery by way of offset.
They're not at risk for that. If I have some 3 minutes for reserve, I appreciate
your time
taking
has expired, counsel.
Thank you.
Mr. O'Hara.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Patrick O'Hara. I represent the Central Laborers Pension Fund. With all due respect, it appears that Mr. Tompkins is arguing that everyone is out of step in the parade except him. And I note that that includes Judge McDade, who Tompkins and his counsel have indicated was misguided in his decision, that he has missed the point on a number of occasions, has failed to appreciate the facts and arguments presented by Tompkins, and has committed numerous errors. This is coupled with an allegation that 14 trustees of an ERISA fund charged with fiduciary duties, half of whom are contributory employers for the fund, half of whom are union representatives, unanimously acted in bad faith and with a conflict of interest. And that is also coupled, according to Mr. Tompkins and his counsel, with the bad faith of three independent counsel for the fund as well, all for the single purpose of denying Mr. Tompkins the opportunity to work 40 hours a week full-time until he reaches $14,000, at which time he indicates that he should have been allowed to quit his work for that year, go home, sit at home, and draw a disability check for total and permanent disability, and then restart that the following year. I would submit that that scenario, that analysis, and those imputations are overwrought and unconvincing. I think the attack of Mr. Tompkins is exemplified by how he handled the notion of the ruling by Judge McDade as to conflict of interest and bad faith.
If I could interrupt, counsel, if you could just focus on the text of the provision in the plan.
$14,000 provision?
Well, the whole thing. This is Section 3.10 in the Amendment 7, which is, I think, the operative document that everybody's using here, since this is sort of a rolling kind of a thing that's amended periodically. And focusing on that text, explain how it is you get to the conclusion that the $14,000 provision, what everybody's referring to as the $14,000 provision within Section 3.10, applies only to part-time work.
Because
as a textual matter.
From a textual matter, I think it's ambiguous. I think the court is correct, and I don't believe in any way, shape, or form that it is unambiguous. The question is whether the reference to such non-laborer employment refers to the type of work that's being performed. These trustees have been used to thinking in terms of types of crafts and types of work being performed. And that was really the dichotomy there of in terms of working either full or part-time as a laborer, which is a very distinctive kind of work. It covers a broad spectrum of work, but it's a specific type of work, whereas the non-labor employment is a type of work. And the provision was not meant to include the entire notion of non-laborer's work for which the work is full-time. The such non-labor employment was supposed to and intended and has been applied and construed by the trustees to refer only to the type of work, that is, non-laborer's work. The whole idea of the $14,000 was...
What's the point of the language referring to employment, non-laborer, or other non-building trades, crafts, employment, for which the employment is considered full-time and a primary source of income?
Well,
what's the point of that language, then, if your interpretation is correct?
It was just indicating that that the overarching criteria for total and permanent disability is that you could not work or could not be capable of that type of work in order to draw a disability pension. And then the trustees took it upon themselves to say, well, we don't want to disqualify someone who has an ad hoc, temporary kind of job somewhere where they earn a few dollars, and they struggled with the notion of, well, how many dollars are we talking about? And they came up with the provision, the benchmark of $14,000. But it was always intended not to allow someone who's capable of working 40 hours a week full-time and draw a disability pension of any kind. Again, the overarching fundamental criteria was that the person, because of physical ability, was not able to work full-time.
Right. And is it the fund's contention that Mr. Tompkins no longer met that definition as a
yes.
physical matter?
Oh, there's no question about it. Mr. Tompkins began work at Willman Construction, driving a truck and delivering materials, and worked full-time. And then subsequent to that, he worked for that outfit for a number of years, and then has changed now to a maintenance personnel at Jumer's Casino, and again is working full-time.
I know that that's the case as a matter of fact, but I'm talking about as a matter of his classification by the physician, which is, it seems to me, what the definition refers to.
By the position or physician? I'm sorry.
By the physician. There's a reference to a certification or classification by a physician that a disability pensioner is no longer able to perform this work, right?
Yeah. I think his disability had to do with a lung condition that he had that he couldn't work around cement dust of some sort.
Right. And so he had this authorization or he had this status by virtue of an assessment by a physician that he met the definition of being permanently and totally disabled because
yeah.
of this
and
problem,
I would say,
and that he was then able to earn up to $14,000.
Yeah. I think the physician's statement that was provided from a form from the Central Laborers Pension Fund, the physician said he was not able to work. And that's what the trustee took it upon themselves to make the decision that he was unable to do so. Had they known at the time that he applied that he was capable of full-time work of any sort in a non-labor position, he wouldn't have gotten his disability benefits in the first instance. But the fund is taking the tack here that Mr. Tompkins apparently recuperated to the extent that he could work full-time, and he had an obligation pursuant to the rules and regulations that were always available to him, in fact, that were provided to him, that if he worked, he was to report any such earnings to the fund. But he didn't do that. He completely ignored that and failed to inform the fund. And so he shouldn't get an advantage as such for not complying with the fund's rules and regulations in that regard. But I think more to the point is that I think Judge McDade was right on when he indicated that the $14,000 provision in the fund's plan is ambiguous. It's subject to two reasonable interpretations. And pursuant to the Morton versus Smith case, that's
what is it about the fund's interpretation that's reasonable as a matter of the text of this provision?
It's reasonable by virtue of the fact that the
By
virtue of the text is that the when it indicates that such employment, such non-labor employment, that's a reference not to such non-laborers' employment for which the employment is full-time, that reference to that phrase, such non-labor employment, refers to the type, the craft, the non-laborer type of craft, the type of work that's being done.
Right, but that carves out a whole chunk of the preceding sentence. So why is that reasonable as a matter of
the text? Well, I think it's reasonable because it's referring to the type of work one is doing. And when you refer to the type of work that one is doing, then you can do non-laborers' work. It's just that you can't earn more than $14,000, and that was intended always and everywhere to refer to part-time work.
It says you can earn up to $14,000, which is what we're arguing about here. That's what he did.
And again, it's the interpretation of that phrase when it was promulgated by the and discussed by the trustees, as indicated by the affidavits of both the chairman of the fund and the assistant administrator, that when it was passed, it was intended to apply only to that phrase, to part-time work, and it had been applied previously to Mr. Tompkins only to part-time work, and it had never been intended nor applied to anything but part-time work.
So does that by way of negative inference from the preceding sentence?
No, again, I understand, and the Judge McDade was
just talk to us and don't tell us what Judge McDade did, because we're in terms of interpreting this clause, we're in de novo review here, and so I need to hear from you, and I haven't heard it yet, what it is a matter of the text of this provision that makes the fund's interpretation reasonable, not the extraneous circumstances evidence, but what about the text?
I think the text makes it reasonable because if you look at, if you focus on just the phrase, such non-labor employment, it can refer just to the type of work that's being done, as opposed to the length of time that it's being performed in terms of full-time employment. And that creates the ambiguity. I didn't mean to invoke Judge McDade's decision other than to say that there's no question that it can be read the other way, Judge McDade said that he'd be inclined to look at it, or Mr. Tompkins would be inclined to look at it. But the fact of the matter is it can have a reasonable interpretation by which the fund has historically and intended to read that, meaning only such non-labor employment refers only to part-time employment. And that was the intention of it. And it was never meant to encompass full-time employment, because if someone's capable of full-time employment, they're not totally and permanently disabled. And that was the reasoning and the interpretation and the construction that the fund provided to it. And I think they are entitled to that pursuant to the deferential standard, as Judge McDade also found. There really isn't any evidence of bad faith here. There certainly isn't any evidence of a conflict of interest. I concur with the notion that every ERISA fund and trustees struggle with the maintenance and the integrity, the financial and fiscal integrity of the fund. That's their fiduciary obligation. And to now impose some sort of aura of conflict of interest because they fulfill those fiduciary duties of being concerned about the fiscal integrity of the fund doesn't mean that that somehow attenuates the integrity of their decision-making on appeals, claim appeals and eligibility appeals. And there's no question that the the trustees acted in good faith. There's no indicia or evidence of any sort with regard to a conflict of interest. And so I believe that the deferential standard is met here. And as the deferential standard, as this court has indicated, is that it has to be patently unreasonable, has to be downright unreasonable. It has to, I think it was stated once that it has to elicit a guffaw, is not an overstatement. Well, I don't think this interpretation does that. It's meant to have been an additional benefit for the participants so that they wouldn't be their benefits wouldn't be rescinded just because they performed short, brief, temporary part-time work and earned a few dollars, as opposed to being able, physically able, to perform full-time work. And so I would ask the court to uphold the decision of the district court in that regard.
And it is correct to characterize this as an argument about offsets in the future.
Yes. There is a provision in the fund that permits offset for repayment of overpayment when the person starts drawing a pension, of early pension or regular pension. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. The case will be taken under advisement.